You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The estimated number of U.S. troops exposed to sarin nerve gas during the Persian Gulf War in 1991 has tripled from 140,000 to 350,000, according to a report released today by the General Accounting Office. Gulf War veteran Gary Bourne was in Iraq near the town of Qamisiyah when he heard an alarm going off all around him and his unit, alarms that signaled that chemical weapons were in the air. He was told that it was a false alarm. 12 years later, he is suffering from exposure to chemical weapons while on active duty in Iraq. Steve Robinson is the executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, one of the organizations that urged the GAO to update its estimate of the number of troops gassed. Peace Watch spoke with him and veteran Gary Bourne today, and we asked Robinson what prompted him to become involved with this issue.
The biggest reason that we've been concerned about DOD modeling is that the modeling that they have used ever since the end of the first Gulf War has been effectively used to deny veterans benefits. You have to go back into history for a moment and remember that when Gulf War veterans first returned home and they started to show up at the Department of Veterans Affairs for treatment, they were told that none of the things that happened to them in the Gulf War could have been reasons why they were ill. This theory kept going for almost 5 to 6 years, when finally the Department of Defense admitted that Gulf War veterans had been exposed to a chemical warfare agent called sarin at a place called Qamisiyah. But they immediately said, but even though we knew that this happened for almost 5 years and we didn't tell you about it, we're going to say that that exposure couldn't be anything that may have caused you an illness. They did that in the absence of science. They just came out and said it. So since 1997, after the admission that Qamisiyah had in fact happened, we've been asking for research into the effects of low levels of chemical warfare agent. And the Department of Defense has continually said that we did a model, the DOD did a model and said we estimated the exposure and there's no way that any of you could have become ill. Well, today, as we sit here, the GAO has released a report that said the modeling that DOD used is invalid and can't be used to make any determinations. Secondly, there is going to be science that will be revealed on June 16th of this month that shows that low-level chemical warfare agents can, in fact, cause long-term illnesses. So really, it's a double whammy in terms of reversing the beliefs about what happened in the first Gulf War.
We are also joined in this discussion by Gary Bourne II. Mr. Bourne, when were you actually in the Persian Gulf? At what time?
I was there from the beginning of September of 90 all the way through the end of the war, April 15th or so. I think we headed April, March maybe. Mm-hmm. We come back in 91.
Were you near the town of Qamisiyah?
Yes, ma'am. I was with HHC 197th Infantry Brigade. We were attached to 24th Infantry Division, one of the main units on the charge into Iraq.
And can you tell us exactly what happened during that time, how you were infected?
We had been going nonstop there. From the day the ground war started, we did not stop until the ground war ended. So by the time the war was over with and they were taking out the weapons and blowing them up, we were already, the war was already over. But we had been 4 or 5 days with very little sleep. We had heard chemical alarms go off and thought little of it, that, it was diesel smoke or something along them lines. Nobody showed any signs of being ill at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, we just assumed that the chemical alarms were defective and, we could go on and complete our task.
And so, Stephen, can you tell us basically what happened in Qamisiyah? How did our troops come to be exposed to the sarin nerve gas?
Right. As I stated earlier, remember, and I keep repeating this because it's important to get the story right. When veterans returned, they were told that there was nothing that they were exposed to. There mm-hmm. were no chemical warfare agents in the theater.
And yet he heard the alarms go off.
Yet he heard alarms go off, as many people did. What we found out later through UNSCOM inspections and through other things was that there was a place called Camisea in which we had, in fact, engineers from the 82nd Airborne had, in fact, conducted a demolition operation. And that demolition operation was conducted against 122-millimeter rockets containing the nerve agent sarin. Now, I have to stop here for a moment and tell you that Camisea was one place and mm-hmm. one demolition. There were multiple places that we conducted demolition operations. But this is the one where DOD admitted that we released chemical warfare agent. And so from that point forward, when they did admit, Gulf War veterans have been fighting for fair treatment and compensation ever since.
And I think what's shocking here, or at least surprising to me, is that the Department of Defense released the chemical warfare agents with full knowledge that our troops were in the path of this? Or
now,
how did that happen?
Here's how it happened. Going back as far as 1988, the CIA knew that this place was a known chemical weapons storage facility. There's some speculation that the information didn't get passed to General Schwarzkopf, and in the conduct of the war, as units were rolling through this area, they went ahead and conducted a demolition operation. But we now know that the CIA knew, in fact, in 1988, that it was a storage facility. So whether it be a matter of miscommunication or someone accidentally forgot to tell General Schwarzkopf that it was there, the point is that soldiers were exposed. And we knew that immediately, and they withheld that information from 1991 until 1997.
And so, according to this updated General Accounting Office report, the estimate has tripled in terms of the number of veterans who were actually affected by exposure to the sarin nerve gas.
Yeah, what they found out was that the original estimate was 140,000 people. That's after years and years of this ever-changing model. And again, they use this model to say that veterans couldn't possibly be ill. But now the GAO has testified that that model is invalid. And so if you combine the DOD model and the Lawrence Livermore model, we would have to notify an additional 250,000 veterans mm-hmm. that they were potentially exposed to chemical warfare agents.
Gary, when did you first begin to feel as though the effects of this sarin gas on personally?
Well, I was seeking help before I ever left active duty in 92, and they continued me on out to the VA. They said, you know, go to the VA, you know, we're releasing you, so you go on to the VA and they'll take care of it from here. And just slowly over the years, it's got worse and worse. More and more symptoms have cropped up over the years, and it's just got harder and harder and harder. I'm 31 years old. I haven't got the first tooth in my head. I've lost all of my teeth. My memory is patchy at best. According to neuronuclear medicine brain spec scan, I have patches of dead brain cells, similar to early stages of Alzheimer's. And as I said, I'm only 31. I don't know the statistics, but I think you got to beat the 31 years on this planet to have that problem.
Mm-hmm. Steve said that they were denying benefits to many veterans. Did you have that experience? Were you denied?
Oh, yes. I've been denied two or three separate times. I've currently got a couple of cases pending. You know, it's been a long, long, drawn-out process. You know, they've got, you know, they're trying to starve people out, and they're being quite successful.
mm-hmm.
Social Security has granted for me so far, and I'm trying to survive and prove up my point of the fact that I'm hurt and this is what caused it.
Steve, Camisea was just one place where U.S. troops were affected by this. There are lots of others. Can you share what the report gleaned along those lines?
Yeah, there are many other places. Camisea was one demolition operation. There was over 100 demolition operations where we don't know what soldiers blew up. There were over 900 sorties or individual bombing missions against multitudes of targets that were known or suspected chemical warfare storage facilities. One of the reasons why we don't find a lot of chemical warfare agents in Iraq right now is because we degraded significantly the ability for them to have those facilities in the first Gulf War, and then we had several years of inspections.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there are some statistics that are very interesting that your listeners may want to know. 697,000 Gulf War veterans deployed to the last war. Over 320,000 have sought treatment from the Department of Veterans Affairs. 214,000 who deployed in the first Gulf War have filed a disability claim, and of that number, 167,000 are receiving one form of compensation or another. Remember, compensation can be 0 to 100%. Most Gulf War veterans receive roughly in the range of 30%, but that doesn't necessarily cover them, because if a guy can't work but he's receiving a disability compensation of 30%, he can't survive off of that.
Mm-hmm. The symptoms that Gary described, the loss of teeth, the loss of memory, are those typical, or are there worse effects from this sarin gas?
There are worse effects. The typical effects for Gulf War veterans are the things that Gary described, progressing into more debilitating diseases like ALS, multiple sclerosis, and ALS, those ALS particularly leading to death. But the science that's being revealed on the 16th says that low-level exposures, even with the absence of first noticeable effects, we've identified there's a genetic predisposition in people. And if you have that genetic predisposition, you're more likely to be harmed from certain things in the environment, exposures to organophosphates, for example. And sarin is just a higher class of organophosphate. So two guys from the same unit could have been where Gary was at. One of them would become ill and the other one wouldn't because of the genetic predisposition. But more significantly, Gulf War veterans are sicker than any other population of war veterans that have returned. And the first Gulf War was classified as the most toxic battlefield that we'd ever fought on. So it's not unusual for me to believe that we're going to see significant health effects from that war.
Steve, the GAO has come out with these new figures and is recommending that any veteran claiming illness related to their active duty in the Gulf War be accepted as fact. That's pretty strong language. Is that a precedent? Is that precedent setting?
It is absolutely. For the GAO to make that statement is a recommendation to the Department of Veterans Affairs to presume that the reason why veterans are ill is because of their wartime experience. We can go back and try to figure out what happened, but because there was no data collected, we're never going to be able to put together a model that will explain how do you become ill from exposure to oil well fires, depleted uranium, investigational drugs and vaccines, chemical weapons exposures, environmental factors. You lay all of those exposures on top of one another, and people will get sick.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you want to say something?
Oh, I would just throw it in sleep deprivation. Oh, we definitely endured some sleep deprivation, 4 days nonstop. We did not stop. It was a rolling battlefield.
How did that affect you?
We were tired. That's the best way to describe it. We wanted to lay down and go to sleep most of the time. But we had task at hand, you know. Personally, there was 18 MPs and 760 prisoners of war at one point. We were quite active, quite busy. We had plenty to keep us occupied, keep our minds active, and try to stay focused.
How does that affect your ability to perform as a soldier?
It slows you down, you know. We had occasions where in the convoy of vehicles, someone would fall asleep in line in the driver's seat, and we would lose the convoy for an hour or something before someone woke him up and we continued and caught up.
Steve, how much weight does a report like this actually carry, this GAO report that is saying, you know, accept it as fact if they come back sick?
The GAO is the investigative arm of Congress.
Yes.
And we believe that the weight that the GAO brings to the table is significant. And because they have made this recommendation, we believe that it has turned the beliefs about what happened in the first Gulf War on its head.
But it seems to me like there was something around Agent Orange. That did the GAO also do reports on Agent Orange, and was that not really enough to force the military to the table on that?
If you go back in history and look at the last 50 years, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to believe that when it comes to exposures or testing or wartime experiences, that our government, our Department of Defense, often takes 30, 20, and for Gulf War veterans, we're at 12 years and counting, to tell the truth about what happened during those experiences. Gulf War veterans have gotten this issue to the forefront a lot quicker because of the experience of Vietnam veterans and Agent Orange. It's a fact that Agent Orange affected people in Vietnam. It's not even debatable anymore. It's a fact that Gulf War veterans had experiences in their service that caused them illnesses. And the GAO's bringing this study out says you can't go back retrospectively in time and guess about what happened if you don't have the data, and then use that data to deny veterans benefits.
So you're optimistic that this report is going to force the Department of Defense to make some critical changes?
Well, absolutely, and they already are making some changes as a result of the exposures that happened in the first Gulf War. The lessons learned about what happened to us have caused them to do certain things, so that's a good thing. Unfortunately, those that fought in the first Gulf War are still fighting for compensation.
Gary, any final words? Gary Bourne, U.S. veteran.
Just holding in there, hoping for the best. I've been fighting them for years, and hopefully it will come to fruition.
Okay. Final thoughts on your part, Steve?
Well, I'd just like to say that if there's any one person on the planet that we owe something to, it's those people that go out and fight to protect our country and our way of life. Whether you believe in war or not, when the soldier gets the task to go, they don't have the option to think politically. They have to do what they're told to do. They have to go and do the thing. So when those people return, if they are ill from a bullet or a bomb or a chemical or a biological weapon, we owe it to take care of them first and foremost and make sure that we do it in a way that tries to restore them as best we can to a functioning ability and gives them some satisfaction for their dedication to our country.
Steve Robinson, Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, and 31-year-old U.S. veteran Gary Bourne exposed to sarin nerve gas activated by the Department of Defense while serving in the Persian Gulf War. With the Federal Communication Commission voting yesterday to relax media ownership regulations to unprecedented levels, many peace activists are wondering how they can disseminate dissenting and anti-war voices through traditional mass media channels in the future. As Iraq fades from the spotlight, the peace movement is also strategizing its next steps, mobilizing to face what it calls the expansion of the U.S. empire. In that vein, the activist group United for Peace and Justice held a high-profile teach-in here in the nation's capital last weekend on the topic of Iraq, preemptive war, and democracy. Among those speaking at the event was Rania Al-Majri, the director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center in Durham, North Carolina, and the founder and coordinator of the Iraq Action Coalition. Dr. Majri spoke about the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and she proposed possible steps for peace.
I think there's a lot of power in language, and therefore we have to be extremely careful about our own language as peace activists. Now, we all know that this war wasn't about liberation. We all know there was no democracy that they're planning, and they're not planning any future democracy in Iraq, because the last thing the administration wants is a representative Iraqi government in Iraq. So we've stopped using the term liberation. But we still use terms such as post-war Iraq and the reconstruction of Iraq. And let's talk about that. Iraq is not in a post-war stage. Iraq is actually in phase 4 of the war. Phase 1 was the 1991 massacre, otherwise known as the Gulf War, 43 days worth of intensive bombardment that killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, civilians and soldiers. Phase 2, the 13 years worth of sanctions that resulted in more than 500,000 children under 5 in Iraq being killed by U.S. UN policies, deliberately killed. Phase 3 is this military invasion and occupation of Iraq that has also led to the death of thousands of civilians, and I want to say clearly for the record, thousands and thousands of Iraqi soldiers, and we need not forget the death of Iraqi soldiers. And now we are in phase 4 of the war. Phase 4 being the occupation militarily and the occupation and invasion economically. We are in phase 4 of the war, what could potentially be the most destructive phase of this very long war against the people of Iraq. Amidst all this, we still hear the term reconstruction. And I've actually heard a few people still use the term rebuild, reconstruct. They're going there to do these things. You know, when we rebuild something, we build what was once there before we destroyed it, right? But if what our government is doing is destroying and then creating something else, it's not called reconstruction. And if what they're creating is something that goes contrary 100% to what was originally there, then it is called deconstruction. And it is the deconstruction of Iraq that they are doing. And they are planning to deconstruct Iraq in a few ways. One, three permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. And we all know how devastating U.S. military bases have been to countries around the world. And if we don't know, we better check and find out. Each one of us need to recognize what U.S. military bases have done, whether it's from the increase of rape to other crimes to simply destroying the country's sovereignty. But more powerfully and more dramatically, we have the economic plans for the country. And you know, one of the good things about having the Bush administration in power is that we don't have to read between the lines. They tell us. And what they have specifically told us, and I quote, "Iraq is open for business." They have specifically stated that one of the primary goals they have is to transform the Iraqi economy into a free market economy, i.e., free for U.S. corporations. They are planning to privatize everything in the country, from the oil field technology to transportation services to telecommunications, even the Iraqi ministries, to parcel them off and sell them, piece by piece by piece, privatizing them. And we know here at home, privatizing sure is not a good thing. On top of this, any member of the Iraqi population who was once a member of the Ba'athist Party, something that typically people did to simply get a job, now you can't get a job under the U.S. occupation forces if you are a member of the Ba'athist Party. We know about the companies that are getting the contracts in Iraq. We've heard about Halliburton. We've heard about Bechtel. How many people here have heard about the Research Triangle Institute in North Carolina getting contracts? $680 million. They've given no money to the Republican Party. We might go, why are they getting contracts? Because they fulfill the same ideology as Halliburton and Bechtel and the others. They are 100% pro-privatization. They did it in South Africa. They have done it in other communities where they go in, they cut up government services, and they sell them to U.S. corporations. So let us keep our eye on institutes such as the Research Triangle Institute just as much as we are keeping our eye on Halliburton and Bechtel. And let's also keep our eye on DynCorp. Because DynCorp has also gotten a good bit of money, approximately $22 to $500 million to do police and prison work. The same company that was involved in the sex trade in Bosnia to now take care of police and prison work in Iraq. This is the kind of deconstruction that they are doing. But it goes beyond, again, economics. It goes also with regards to foreign policy. What is the only foreign mission in Iraq that was invaded by U.S. occupying forces? 40 troops went into the Palestinian mission, 40 troops arrested 11 Palestinian diplomats, stole everything from computer files to weapons, which they legally had the right to have, to vases, and ransacked the mission, aka Israeli occupation style. This was their first attack against a foreign mission in Iraq. And just so that they can legitimize arresting diplomats, they then said, we will remove all diplomatic immunity against all diplomats in Iraq, but you know, we're only going to enforce that against Palestinians, which really seems very similar to the way they do civil rights here. Yes, we have civil rights for everybody unless you happen to be a person of color or low-income community, then you know, that really doesn't apply to you. They ransacked the Palestinian mission. Right now, 90,000 Palestinian refugees in Iraq are threatened with eviction. Most of these Palestinians come from Haifa, which means they have been refugees since 1948, which means they have nowhere to go. Because these 90,000 Palestinians, as well as the 6.5 million Palestinian refugees, are denied the right to go home because they are Christian and Muslim and not Jewish. And that is the sole reason the Israeli government will not let them go home. The roadmap that the U.S. government is pushing on the Palestinian Authority, this roadmap does not speak about the right of return, does not speak about the dismantling of settlements, does not speak about Jerusalem. it doesn't speak of anything worth speaking about. And it is important to recognize how linked the Palestinian suffering is to the Iraqi suffering. It is not a choice for us as activists to say, I'm going to work on Iraq. No, I'm going to work on Palestine. We really don't have that choice. Either work on human rights in the region, or we don't work on human rights in the region. Those of us who preach solidarity with Iraqis and Palestinians need to recognize you cannot be preaching solidarity with Palestinians and not be standing 100% with the right of return. At the same time, we cannot, and I know this, there is some discussion out there about maybe this is not the time for the U.S. occupation forces to leave Iraq. Maybe they need to stay because there's chaos in the country and they need to stay to cause stability. I say what is wrong is wrong. An occupation is an occupation is an occupation.
Lebanese environmental scientist, scholar, and social justice activist Rania Almazri is speaking at last weekend's United for Peace and Justice teach-in on Iraq, Preemptive War and Democracy here in Washington, D.C. Thanks to the D.C. Radio Co-op and Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer from Pacifica Station WPFW, for production assistance with that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Abel Hamid of KPFA, Pete Weiss, Jabari Zakia, Eddie Becker, and T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.